Oh, hey, by now you probably know that Mythic Bastion Hunt is written by Chris McDowell and has amazing art by Alex Sorensen, and that The Smiling Fox is a fan-made project by three random nerds. Today, though, we have a professional nerd on the show, Thomas Manuel. He will talk about his experience being a player on the Actual Play YouTube channel. If you're coming from a more OSR background like me, where story is an emergent property that organically comes out of random roles and player decisions, you will be intrigued by Thomas's storytelling approach. But whether you prefer emergent story or storytelling, always remember, don't trust the smiling fox. Welcome to The Smiling Fox. My name is Horst.
I am Brian.
And hey, I'm William.
And today we would like to talk about improvisation, emergent story, and I couldn't imagine a better guest. For today we have a prolific podcaster with the Yes Indeed podcast, a renowned journalist with the online magazine Rascal, and the editor of probably the best role-playing newsletter out there called the Indie RPG Newsletter. Welcome, Thomas Manuel.
Wow, I appreciate that, Horst. Thank you. I'm excited to talk.
The first thing we would like to talk to you about is your experience with Mythic Bastion, and obviously. And you had a pretty interesting setup. Can you talk about that?
I'm not actually the kind of person that might have picked up and played Mythic Bastion Land by myself, right? Like I'm not an OSR person. That's the community or space I think this game comes out of. And while I really enjoy reading about it, I love the ideas that come out of that space, I don't play in that play style. But yeah, I was invited to a game, I think after Quinn's made that video review on Quinn's Quest, I think, and there was a lot of like buzz around Mythic Bastion Land. I was invited to a game by Judd Kalman, who is a friend of mine, and we've been talking about playing a game together, and he was like, I'll run this. And Judd is somebody who, you know, has been running games for a very long time, really loves like Cairn and like Into the Odd and stuff like that. He hacks them. He has opinions of, you know, what kind of D&D he wants and stuff like that. So he said he'd run the game for me, invited me. And then we had a second player, Jay Brown, who is a podcaster, and he writes a newsletter as well called Play Fearless. And he's somebody I've played with before. Jay ran a game of Legacy, Life Among the Ruins for me, which was such a great game. Yeah, so that was pretty cool. It was one GM, two players. And we did three sessions, then took a break and time skipped, created new characters and played three more sessions. And that was also interesting. Yeah.
But you also started as mature characters, is that right?
It's that thing of like starting the game out and Judd was like, what do you want to do? And we were like, what's the thing that we're not supposed to do? Like, you know, let's start as rulers.
I always think of starting as young knights to be the default. Is there anything in the book that suggests that? Or is it just the first in the list, I guess?
You know, Chris McDowell is... his prose is so spare, like he would not waste the words in telling you, you know, which one he assumed you would take.
And starting as mature knights, that meant that you had to be included kind of in the realm creation process to some degree.
We discussed before we got on to that first session that we were going to play these. Yeah, I think I'm not sure that if the term in the book is rulers, but yeah, we decided we were going to do that. And then Judd made the kingdom by himself. He made the map. And I think he did that primarily because he wanted to pick the myths that were in play. He didn't roll them randomly. He read through and he was like, I'm excited by these six. And this is something I want to talk about. And he did a really interesting thing with those myths where they were very specifically tied to the characters that we made, you know, in a way that I don't think the game assumes.
I've listened to this week. So I think Jay was playing the ruler and the previous ruler had died and was the Spectre.
Yeah.
And I think his sister was missing because she had gone to the mountain.
So we weren't the lord of the entire realm, but the realm is broken down into domains, right? So Jay was the ruler of one specific domain. I was his hand. Like Ryan said, yes, there was a missing older sister who would have been the ruler if she had been here. But since the ruler died and only Jay was there, sort of like that was the setup. And like Ryan said, Judd immediately made the first myth that we ran into, the Spectre, be the Spectre of the king that we had just replaced, right? And that was cool. That was immediately like very cool.
And what did you like about this? Was there more like attachment to what is going on? More involvement for the characters?
Yeah, exactly. I think that suddenly there was something emotional happening here. It wasn't that there was a ghost that was haunting the lands, and because it was our duty to protect the land, we were going to like banish this ghost. No, here was somebody who was not letting go of the throne, and the throne has my friend on it. So either you let go or I have to kick your ass. So there was this very clear thing here where I was like, the previous king is embarrassing himself, you know, by being this ghost and not letting go. So there was a kind of, we both cared more about this in a very fundamental way. And defeating that person was the first step in justifying the decision to become the ruler, right? Like justifying that this character was worthy of being the ruler. So it had this emotional stakes to it. Yeah.
I liked it because it was more than just, here's a specter that's kind of creepy, we need to get rid of it. But it did like add like a little bit more motivation. At least as a listener, that's something that I took away.
And did you decide beforehand or during play about your character's relationship to Jay's character?
It was a decision, soon as we picked that we were going to be rulers, we knew one of us had to be the ruler and the other person would be their right hand. And this is one of those things where I'm like, I would rather be the person being the right hand, and I was really happy to be that person because that gives me such a clear picture of what I want to do, which is not usurp them or something like that, but rather I get to be the guy that's saying like, hey, let me handle this, you know? Like, just be like, you know, listen, like, you know, any problem, I step in first. I have a very clear sense of like what my job is, and it's to keep this guy safe. And then in the first session he died, so you know.
When you play games in general, do you like playing supporting characters?
It's not about supporting or leading or anything like that, because I think when you say things like that, people start thinking that this is about spotlight or importance or anything like that. The thing here is that I like having a clear relationship, right? Like I like knowing how I feel about somebody else and that giving me like a sense of what to do in a scene, because otherwise I have to just kind of decide it, right? I have to be out of nowhere, be like, what do I think about this? Like, you know, and having a kind of clear relationship of being like, I really love this person or I really hate this person. Like that's easy and that's nice. And so that's kind of what I like to do. So that, I think one of the nice things about this game, again, is that like if you lean into the sort of like romantic fantasy about knights, then you can all kind of really, really support each other. In the first time we were leaning into the more classical thing of like, we love each other, we love this realm, like we are noble and we have these ethics, and that was great. Yeah.
I think that there's also an element, at least hinted in the book, that as soon as you have a domain, if you rule over a holding, it will be some kind of disaster management in a almost soap opera way, where you have all these courtiers vying for your attention with different agendas. But I have another question, Thomas, about the knight that you rolled the knight, classic.
We rolled, yeah.
And how different was that from, let's say, PBTA playbook? Was that cool, or would you rather had picked something?
I am the kind of person that even if I was playing a PBTA game, I would be happy to roll and play randomly. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy with random. I'm very happy with improvisation. And so I loved rolling the knight. It felt very similar to a PBTA playbook. Like in that sense, it felt like I was getting like a specific character, you know what I mean? Like rather than like a class or an archetype, and then I have to decide who this person is or something like that. It felt like I was getting the knight, right? And I love that kind of stuff.
Do you remember what you had to roll for your knight? Like, did this give you some more flavor for the knight?
I don't think so. Like, I don't know if this is like a controversial like opinion or something, but almost nothing on that little sheet is load-bearing or important, or I don't even know if it really helped me. Like, the big thing that helps you is just the words, maybe the little poem, the picture. Mm. Sometimes the ability is very flavorful. It wasn't, I can't remember anything else being particularly like important, you know? Like, I remember the second character more than the first. And I think the second character had like a bag of teeth, you know what I mean? And I can imagine a world in which that became a big detail, but it was a bag of baby teeth. That's what I rolled. That is one of the
holy
things.
Shit.
Yes. That might have been my first character, actually, because I think the second one had skin of something. But yeah, I can't remember that I did anything with that first character's like choice there. The thing that's useful is just the description of the knight.
I listened to your interview with Prismatic Wastelands, F.W. Smith. We were talking briefly about what makes a good player. If there's an encounter, you could, in theory, just ignore it if it's not kind of a sticky encounter. And you said something like, hold on a minute, a good player doesn't just ignore the manic street preacher on the street corner. They would engage with it.
Yeah.
Is that something like being proactive, being interested in in the world?
There is a thing that happens when you first start playing role-playing games, and you might get the wrong idea that what you do is to play a character, and then you have to think, what would my character do? Be like honest to that, this very like theatrical way. And this doesn't happen to everybody, but it can happen to some people, right? And so, like, I think it's important in that context to be like, no. if the GM describes something and like it is good play to like engage with it. But at the same time, I think after you've played a lot, you do get to a stage where you're like, you can tell the difference between here's the thing the GM is saying and I can engage with it or I can't. And you can have that sort of like relationship. It's almost like good play is making a character that would engage, right? Again, a very common piece of advice, I think, to new players, yeah.
Because I GM a lot more than I play, I am often, when I'm playing in a game, I will sometimes stop and think, what's the GM trying to do? Or is there something that maybe that they're worried about, that things aren't going in the way? You know, I'll try and put myself in their shoes, and I might occasionally steer things in a way that I think, not what they want to do, but if I feel like something's being closed off that maybe they want to remain open, I might try and engage with that.
But I'm sure there's many situations in which, like, I'm sure the majority of the situations are situations in which you're not trying to read the GM's mind in any way, right? Like, you know?
Yeah.
So then in which case, like, which one do you think you're doing? Do you think you're going like, who is my character and how would they respond to this? Or are you like, what would be interesting to happen here? Or are you like, hey, I've never done that before. Let me, what happens if I do that?
It's probably more the first. Okay. I think it's probably having some kind of character motivation and building from that.
I think for me, I don't know, maybe a blend of the two, because I try and play a character, but you got to play it in a way that others can respond to it. I think that in our play-by post, my goal in at least 80% of the posts have been that either someone is going to read this and be like, oh, that's interesting to know, or read it and then have an immediate reaction of what's either the GM has the world react to it, or the player has something that they can say in return. Yeah. When I'm playing, I'm somewhat actively trying to do that, where it's like the character itself is so thick that there's something that someone else can bounce off of.
I was asking, what is a good player? And I think a good player is trying to draw in other player characters and try to create some kind of relationships. We knew that the player experience would be a topic for today's episode. I ran for the last 2 weeks a playbook post of Mythic Bastionland. So I think Brian and William could be players for the first time.
Yeah, that's my first time being GM'd. I have played with myself as well, but rolling a night and having that experience, first time doing that. So it was interesting to hear the discussion there about what do you get when you roll a night, you know, what's on that page and how much motivation does that give you with what comes next. Like for me, I rolled the true night, which I think is one of the ones which is, it's very easy to say, this is a person who cares about truth and will get really annoyed about anyone lying. And that's enough to play for a session without thinking any more deeply about who this person is.
You rolled that night where it's kind of obvious what to do. And then I rolled the Weaver Knight, where I didn't really look at their abilities and properties that much, but the art is somewhat jester styled. Running off that, just vibes only, I'm like, wanted to make my character a bit more of like a fool, somewhat difficult to deal with. I wasn't inspired by much of the text at all.
I think the Weaver Knight has the ability to swap an item that they have in their hand with a similar item that they see, which is pretty powerful when you're using it creatively.
Yeah, I think I rolled the Key Knight the first time I played, and I don't know whether I used the Key Knight's ability, which is sort of the Blades in the Dark ability of being once per day just declaring that you have a common item, you know, just pull it out of my backpack, here it is. But, you know, that just never happened.
The first time I read that night, I thought it'd be like the perfect Reddit user that's it's like, actually, I do have one of those.
So maybe we can talk a little bit more about the player experience.
Yeah.
Did you adjust your play style to Mythic Bastionland, or did you adjust it to the table culture with Jay and Judd? Or is it like you approach every game kind of in the same mode?
I did not feel like I had to adjust at all. I think one of the nice things about OSR games or rules right games in general is that they are so neutral about playstyle and play culture, right? Like this is a strength and a weakness. This is why I'm not usually bringing them out to play, because I like games that are more opinionated sometimes. I didn't have to like adjust at all, but that's also because, again, I think Judd does run that game, again, in the way that a lot of games that I usually play are run, right? Like, which is, again, you know, why is he making the Spectre the father of Jay's character, right? Like, why is the Peacock Knight, which is, again, just like two words in the description of the mountain myth, one of them becomes Jay's character's sister. So when Jay dies, my whole thing as a character becomes, I am now ruler of the realm against my wishes, or rather because I let down my friend and let him die. So like my whole thing becomes, I want to go find his older sister and convince her to come back to become ruler, because that's the right thing to do, right? And so this mountain myth, which is kind of weird, and these Peacock Knights are not particularly like relevant, suddenly become extremely personally involved to the characters, right? Like I'm scaling this mountain because I want to find this one particular person. And that's interesting. That's very naturally my playstyle.
So what Judd did is have the players be especially interested in the cast of the myth. I would claim that the way the omens are written are so open that it kind of lends itself to improvisation. And I was reminded of, are you familiar with A Thousand Thousand Islands?
Yeah.
Because if you read these adventures or setting/adventures, they have the same kind of very broad strokes. They're so open. You have to improvise. There's no other way. Do you see like a parallel between the writing of Chris McDowell and of Zedek Zinu?
Yeah, I think Zedek Zinu is a very good writer for sure, and one of the best prose writers working in RPGs right now. They do both have a very spare style, a very minimalist style, and I think that is definitely a similarity. Whether that kind of necessitates improvisation, like I do agree. As a GM, it's not maybe my favorite kind of improvisation to do. You know, I was not excited about running Mythic Bastion Land, actually, because I was like, it's in terms of like an exploration game, in terms of like a hex crawl game, I wasn't quite sure what was going to be really fun about it. I don't have any connection to knights. Okay, this is also an important thing to say, like in the sense that there's no emotional reaction to me. I'm not like, oh, let's tell a knight story. Like, I don't know what a knight story is. And when Judd ran it, I was like, oh, you can do this? You know what I mean? Like, that was my reaction. I was like, whoa, you can make this game feel like not only that it's extremely responsive to what we are doing, but that like we feel like big parts of it, right? I feels like my character has a history in this world and feels very connected to this world, right? I'm not treating it in some instrumental way. I'm not exploring it for the sake of just seeing what's there or like acquiring an object or anything like that. Like I care about it. And I was like, that's cool. You know, like that was a kind of revelation to me when Judd ran. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, cool. Now I can run this game too. And I think I can figure out what I would have fun with. But yeah, going back to why I don't particularly have this knight fantasy or anything like that. There was this moment that happened in the game where Judd introduced this myth. I think they're called the Order. And the Order came in and they're a very good kind of character to introduce into any story, which is that we're knights, but we're better knights.
I think the knight thing, I think different people think of it differently. One of the most common things I see people comment on it, we're trying to get people interested in the game, is they mention the movie The Green Knight, which I haven't seen, so I don't know how helpful that is. But I think in reality and in the game, there's the idea of what a knight is supposed to be and what a knight actually is. So you have this aspirational thing of the knight is honorable and trying to do the right thing. But if you look through, you know, the passions of the knights in the game, their passion could be they like to bring up an uncomfortable topic in conversation, or they like to take credit for something they didn't do. They're not the perfect knights that, you know, they are maybe aspiring to be. I think that's interesting because it gives people anything which steers players in a way where they have something they are aspiring to do or trying to achieve, but also something that's pulling them back. That is a flaw or something grounding them, I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, the Dove Knight is described as very naive and kind of youthful, and they are revengeful. Their passion is that they have to, you know, take revenge on someone, and that tension is really cool.
I think it's picking up a thread that we discussed a little bit earlier about the idea of things coming up in the game and players maybe don't engage with them or not. And also on that topic of the sparseness of the writing, I think sometimes people read through the myths and they look at the omens and they read the omen as saying, this is a story. It has a beginning and it has an end. And the story will happen regardless of what a player does. And for someone who's planning to run the game, there's a fear that all you're doing is telling the players, oh, this thing is happening. There's a mountain in the realm now. And now the mountain is gone. And some people were creeped out by the mountain. I think potential referees are scared that you present this to players and they just say, okay, well, we're just extras in this story. So I'm curious from the player perspective. Aside, we've already talked about the idea that you're personally invested because someone you know is on the mountain.
Yeah.
But do these myths seem like things that players can bounce off of because there's nothing for them to latch onto, or there's nothing for them to say, oh, here's the obvious way for me to engage in this?
And that is like a spectrum across these myths, right? Some of them are very clearly like, here's a bad thing, stop it. And some of them are a bit more ambiguous. And some of them like even more neutral, almost. Not even neutral. Like, I'm pretty sure in the first game, we teamed up with the myth to defeat the Lord of the Realm. Playing now, I see these myths differently than I did when I read the book, which is like, oh, like some of this can just be color. Right? Like some of this can just be like, this is how the world is. And that's interesting. And we don't have to worry too much about like making all six the most immediate threat, right? Where you see it and you're like, I need to go handle this because my job is handling things. There's a spill in the supermarket, I have to mop it up. Like that kind of, oh, the GM is just giving me jobs to do. That is a thing that I could have fallen into, like as a GM. I could have been like, look at all of these problems. Like, I'm going to just, you know, which one are you going to handle? You have to handle them all. Whereas this thing of like, oh, no, like the world is just mysterious. And we'll play through some of these out depending on which omens come up. But otherwise, it can just be mysterious. It can just be a facet of the world that there's a glade with three hunters in them. And that never has to escalate past that. It never has to become the problem it could be. Similar to, there was this myth called the child. And that was great color. And we never proceeded with it. But it was so cool that it was happening in the background. Right? Like, you know, and that was good. Again, that I think really contributed to this feeling of, hey, there is a world here, and it is not just a world of problems.
From my perspective, it's almost like story problems, that something is happening, and now we want to see how the knights react to it, I don't know, emotionally, interpersonally, rather than here is a problem or an obstacle that you have to overcome. I think the first, I don't know, forest myth omen is, they are just birds falling from the sky, and they were singing, and now they're on the floor and their heartbeat is really fast and they sing. That is not an obstacle. You can just walk past these birds.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of thing. Like, that feels like a very standard sort of, like, again, this is not a criticism of the book, but this is an omen of like a bad thing is happening here. Like, care about it. Right? Like, care about it. And I think as a good player, you're supposed to look at that and go like, I need to figure out what's going wrong. Like, the birds are dying. Like, that's good. Like, I do think that's the standard thing. I guess the interesting thing is there are all these other things that can be. And as a GM, I would, if I ran this game, be picking the myths or like roll the myths and see like, oh, like, do I have a mix of stuff that where some of it feels like the world is just weirder than I imagined, rather than here's a bad thing, get to the bottom of it. The mountain, for example, is like a very weird myth. I think you resolve the mountain by getting to the top of it. There are no rules, or there's no real way for you to make climbing that mountain particularly like interesting. Right? The myth is just, again, those omens, right? It doesn't say you're climbing a whole mountain. What do you do when you climb this mountain, right? And that's the thing, right? When we played it, we had a couple of scenes where we met NPCs, and then Judge just described us getting to the top of the mountain. Like, that was it. It was not particularly interesting to spend a whole session talking about how hard it was to get to the top of the mountain. The interesting thing was getting to the top, and we just got there. And that's nice as well. I would have never have picked the mountain because I would have felt this challenge of like, how do they make them feel they earned climbing to the top or whatever, you know? And I would have overthought that. So I'm glad that in play it was actually fine.
But it's almost like, to me, that it has a very story-like element to it. Because if you're writing a story and your main characters are knights climbing up a mountain, there is a story where climbing up the mountain itself is the struggle, and every step, you know, every chapter is them getting, you know, a little bit higher and a little bit higher. I find the more, I guess, romantic Arthurian version is also like, you're on the mountain and halfway up, you have an encounter with someone and the next thing is you guys are at the top, and you know, then something epic happens. So I do think like something like this is really good for leaning into that kind of, again, the more romantic knightly stories.
Yeah. I think that's a big thing in Mythic Bastionland is you see that it's a hex crawl game and that it has procedures for dealing with movement or travel. And then you might expect that everything will be very incremental and you'll get here and you'll explore this and you come across that boundary. But the story elements of it are a little bit more episodic. Sometimes there's a climax moment and it just makes sense just to jump to that rather than to say, now we'll do 3 days of wandering through the wilderness before you get to this thing that we all want to get to.
And that is a very story game kind of thing to do, right? And that's what I'm trying to say. Like, I imagine some people would be deeply unhappy with having a mountain be the myth and to have no challenge to overcome in terms of getting to the mountain, right? Like, I don't want to speak for that person. I can't imagine, you know, their problems and like talk to them. I can be like, yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting thing about Mythic Bastion that it works great in this mode.
I think that's also one of those things where if you as a referee understand your players at the table and that they would be more interested in a challenge to get to the top, that the site system is quite a decent way to come up with some, you know, there are different paths to get up and different challenges you meet along the way. And in that sense, you can have more of like a challenge to get to the top. So
I think it's a good advice to read the table to see what kind of play style would your players prefer. And if they are more challenge based, then maybe either pick myths that present a challenge, an obvious one, or if you have randomly roll them, make them more challenging by maybe including sides. Do you think that Mythic Bastionland is maybe a good gateway drug for either story gamers to get into kind of more an OSR style of play or OSR gamers that maybe want to branch out into story games?
That's a great idea because I think the answer is completely yes, right? Like, I think it is a game that does sit in the middle. It has flavors of both, lends itself to both in very interesting ways. Like, for example, like, as a person who doesn't run a lot of either triad games or OSR games, like, one of the big things that leads me away from those kinds of games is like combat. When I used to run 5th edition, the real problem with that game was that like I was in charge of making combat interesting. And can the game do this for me, please? Like, why as the GM am I feeling so much pressure and then failing, like feeling bad, you know, about like, I wanted this to be really exciting and it's not. And that feeling was awful as a GM, as a DM. Like, I didn't enjoy that. And it stressed me out and made running that game unfun. And if somebody can do that with that game, I have only respect for them, right? As a player in Mythic Bastionland, the combats were almost uniformly the most dramatic thing possible, right? They didn't take long, but they were also extremely, extremely like poignant and dramatic and intense and still janky, I think, in a good way. Like, I think role-playing games are fundamentally messy and like it's fine for them to be messy. We had such intense fight scenes where we would win, you know, through lucky dice rolls, the skin of our teeth. And then I'd be like, if Judd remembered that he could do these things, he would have won that. You know? And I'm like, I didn't tell him, but if I did.
What do you think makes the Mythic Bastionland combat system so interesting? You're not hitting like a gigantic blob of HP until the HP is depleted. Yeah. Anything else that makes it really exciting and there are all these interesting choices?
Yeah, I think part of it is the thing that makes Cairn interesting and Into the Odd interesting or whatever. It's just that like you have these dice rolls that really matter and there's a lot of tension in them where you're like, I roll 3 8s in a row, I'm smashing everything. And if I roll 3 threes in a row, I'm dying. And that the difference between that is so small. And like that feeling of really being on the edge of your seat when you roll these dice, knowing that they're only two or three and that's it. Like that's very good. And then Mythic kind of makes it even better because you have these, like you said, these very specific choices to make that do tend to cover a lot of creative ground and lets you do the things that you want to do, which is like not just hit things, right? Like it gives you this space of like doing all these stunts and things like that. And it handles that very elegantly and gives you this thing of like, okay, I want to pull out all the stops in this fight. It matters a lot to me. And it's a really good combat system. And obviously, it is swingy as hell, right? I don't feel like it's player skill or something like that. That's not what I'm, you know, that's not the feeling I get as a player. I'm not like, I'm so good at this game. I am making the combos. I'm making the right choices. That's not really important to me.
And then the narrative aspect of it, you roll all these dice, then you say, okay, I use this to impair and this to move. But then you also tie it into like an action narration, what's going on screen,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Before digging into that too deep, it's worth pointing out that can be a little bit more collaborative maybe than in other games because you're rolling together.
It does let you do more. And this gets into like almost superheroics where like you can be like we're deciding together. So like even though we're playing this like knight game, I'm describing how like you use your shield as a to boost me up and then I fly, you know, across 12 feet and I can do all this cool stuff. It's fine. Like the end of the game absolutely like facilitates that. And that's fun. Like if it didn't have this system, if it was just Cairn, that moment would not have happened. This collaborative after the fact description wouldn't happen in the same way.
I agree with that because like the, especially like live games, people will all roll their dice and then you, in a glance, you can see, hey, that's a high number. We can use that for this. You got fours or higher, so we can do it for this. And like that level of collaboration happens, I find, very, very quickly. And it's also, I've never found it unbalanced that one person is dictating. It seems as if everyone kind of, it's easy to like latch onto something that makes sense for your character in that moment.
Yeah, just the earlier discussion about, to some extent, what is a knight? And one of the answers that it's offered here is a knight is someone who can do feats. It is a little bit like being a superhero, you know, that you can say, I'm going to smite now. And this is not something an average person can do. And there's no real explanation. I've had in my campaign the experience of a squire becoming a knight. So you have this character who, for a long time, couldn't do that. And now they can do that. So we had a little bit of discussion with who taught you this? You know, where did you learn how to do that? But it is almost like, you know, you've become one of the X-Men.
You would ask the player, where did you learn this? So you would kind of include the player into establishing facts about the world.
Yeah, exactly. So there were three feats. So I thought it would be fun to say, a different person taught you each of these. So who taught you these? And then it was a combination of other player characters and an NPC. I've no interest in telling someone this is the history of your character, that, you know, this is what happened to you. I'm more interested in hearing them tell me that.
And do we all have tricks to foster that kind of player creativity? Prompting questions, I think, makes sense.
Yeah, I think questions are my favorite way of doing this. As a GM, it's one of my favorite things to do is to come up with like a good question to ask them, which both gives me something and gives them something. Like in this situation that Brian was describing, I might be very specific, right? I might be like, you entered a tournament, you know, last year where you saw someone smite and then you were like, I need to learn that. So who did you learn from? You know, that kind of, I might do more than somebody else might do.
That is really good advice, I think, for players who are a little bit in their shell. If you just tell them, you know, who taught you and they have no context, they could feel intimidated. But if you describe it like Thomas did, there was this situation, it makes it easier to pull them out of their shell.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. I struggle sometimes getting players to engage in that manner. And then it's like you say, you ask a question and they kind of look at you blankly, or they give you kind of like a bit of a basic answer that doesn't really give me much to work with. For me, that's probably the hardest thing I find, especially taking people coming from other games where you're not expected that you improv with the referee as much. To kind of like foster that is still something that I find very, very difficult.
If I feel like they don't have immediately, like something has not come to mind, sometimes you can see somebody thinking about something, but they don't say it. So sometimes it's just your job to just get it out. Sometimes it feels like they don't have an idea, is think about options and then to give them options, right? Like in this very specific thing, I would be like, oh, would you like it if it was like another squire? Or would you prefer it was like an old knight who had like a big, like who had a big reputation, like that kind of thing. And that, you know, is functionally the same question, like, you know, but because they could say, and this happens very often, they'll say a third thing.
Yeah. And I think you can also try to build something from it. You know, you could say, who taught you this and what have they asked in return? Or, you know, they will have asked for something in return, and then you introduce what that is. And then you now have, okay, now you can smite, but also you have a favor to repay to someone.
And what Judd would do is that as soon as they said, like, who taught them the smite, he would make that person one of the knights in the myth that they're going to meet, right? Like, he'd be like, okay, just look at some myth and there's a named character and he just replaces the name. They just joined the order. What are you going to do about it?
I'm curious because maybe it was the way that the actual play was shown on YouTube. Did you have access to the map, or was it only Judd who could see the map?
I had access to a picture of the map.
But there was no tokens, or did you know for certain where you were on the map, or are you just kind of like going based on his descriptions?
Yeah, we didn't know. Like in the sense that it was interesting, because I have the feeling what happened is that like a lot of the travel was just happening, like Judd was handling it and we didn't know we had gone from hex to hex.
Yeah, because I remember a moment early on when he said something like, okay, you're leaving the holding and you can go by river and you can go this way and you can see this. You could go towards this thing or you could go this other way. And it sounded like the travel was almost like theater of the mind kind of travel, which I actually think I'm in a campaign and we're very in our routine of everyone looks at the map and we have little tokens and people are drawing things on the map and we all enjoy that. But I do see the appeal of the map is not visible, because it feels more, I'm not going to say realistic, because this is a mythic world with all sorts of strange things happening. But these people in this era would not have, you know, their sat-nav telling them where they are. And it's an interesting approach, I think.
It feels less gamey. It feels more maybe immersive is a way. You're part of nature. You see the mountain there and there's a forest over there. And as soon as you move tokens over a map, it becomes something that you're not part of, but that you look at like objectively from top down.
Horst has been running this play-by-post for us. And because I wasn't looking at the map, even despite all of your wonderful efforts updating the map in a location I wasn't looking at, to me, the travel felt very dangerous and very uncertain.
The thing that happens also is that these omens become just a way of describing the travel. You kind of want travel to have a certain pacing or a certain, you want to have it to have some texture, and the omens kind of do that, where you're just like, okay, you know, every time we crossed a hex, Judd would describe this omen to us, probably like whenever he rolled an omen, like he would describe it to us. And it very naturally gave us a sense of like, okay, we've done a lot of traveling.
But I think Judd also rolled on the nature tables to give, you know, nature some more details. In Mythic Bastionland, this is all on the referee side. But I want to point out one interesting scene from your campaign, the second campaign, where you were at a lake and it was very salty. And then the job of the referee would be then to describe how it looks like. And you said, what if the lake is so salty that the pilgrims float on it? And I thought that was a beautiful picture. To me, that is being a good player.
That is a thing that, again, I would not normally I would be careful about doing, right, if I didn't know the GM, because you don't know whether someone's going to enjoy that or not. But I knew that if I was the GM and I said a description and the player was excited enough to be like, and that's why I say what if, right? I give the GM the option to say no, you know, but if I had a player who was excited enough to be like, oh, is it like that because of this? And they're paying attention and they're responding, I would really enjoy that. The other thing also happened, just in case anybody's listening, was like sometimes like Judd would be like in the second game, the Lord of the Realm, who was an NPC in our first game, the new Lord of the Realm was missing. And I would be like, Judd, what if the Lord of the Realm is with the elf? So when we, you know, maybe they're there and the elf puts charms on people and it's up to Judd, and Judd did not say yes to that, right?
There was the other scene where Jay suggested that the elves were banished by onions and bells, and Judd rolled on the 2d6 table what is actually the case and didn't go with it. So that there are obviously limits to narrative authority on the side of the on the players.
As a player, you have to be okay with that input not being accepted as well, right? It's absolutely the case. This technique did give us probably one of the coolest moments in our second game, where after we defeated the elf, Judd was like, okay, like, what do you want to do? And Jay, in character, sort of proposed to the elf, what if we meet every year and we do this as a ceremonial ritual and blood will be spilt and the seasons will happen? And it was really like beautiful, mythic, poetic thing to be like, we've just had this battle that almost killed us, and now every year somebody from each side will come here and recreate it ritualistically.
I think that there are other ways to kind of integrate players into establishing facts about the world. So what I do is, especially if I don't have the energy to improvise the time, during travels, I roll the spark tables and I just tell the players the results, and then they have to describe how cool it looks. Very often their description are just 10 times better than anything I could have come up with. Also because at some stage as the referee, you are getting a bit tired, and activating the players like that is pretty cool.
This is suggesting a question to me. We already asked, could this game help someone expand their experience into OSR or story games, depending on what their background is? Do you think this is a good game for someone who's only ever been a player to play this and then think, oh, maybe I could run a game?
I think any game could do that, you know, depending on how you run it, like in the sense that this game doesn't specifically create opportunities for players to narrate or describe things. These are all like GM techniques that we've talked about, right? So like, but yeah, I think one of the benefits of techniques like this, which is like, here's the prompt I got, what's the weather looking like? Like that stuff is definitely, as a technique, is great. As GMs, you know, why do you want to hoard all the creativity for yourself, you know? And also because it is, like Horst said, like exhausting sometimes to improvise for 3 hours straight. Yeah.
When we were talking earlier about players feeling like they can either engage with something or not, or feeling pressured, one of the things I've heard from a player in the past is that they felt that they had to do a thing because they assumed I had done a lot of preparation and that the preparation would be wasted if they didn't, you know, this little kid ran up and tried to steal some food for them and ran away. And they thought, well, clearly he's got a whole background and we've got to go chase after him, even though I don't care that he's taken my sandwich. And he, for him, it felt like now I've got this chore to, because we were in the middle of something else. But if you let people see behind the screen a little bit and say, you know, I rolled thief boy and that thing happened. It's not my like secret storyline that you have to explore.
This is the exact opposite of the thing, right? I said like people come in with certain assumptions. Like one assumption is they like think they have to be true to their character's thing. And the other assumption is they think they have to do whatever the GM wants, because otherwise they're being mean to them or they're doing bad. So like, these are both traps on like either side.
Brian, you asked the question, is Mythic Bastionland a good game for a first-time referee? Oh. And there is definitely super good refereeing advice all over the book. I'm not sure that if you are in the game and you have to run it, that you can, you know, have all these good advice in your head. But it is there if you need it. I think Mythic Bastion is probably a difficult game for a first-time GM, because there's a lot of improvisation on the side of the referee. So I would probably pick a game that has a bit more procedures that you can rely on. I think prepping, for example, is for new GMs a way to make the stress smaller. It probably gives you a good feeling that you can fall back on your prep, whereas Mythic Bastion doesn't have that.
Maybe Cairn might be a better starting point, and then make a quick shift after having enough experience to Mythic Bastion, then might be a better route. I think there are, I don't know, techniques, skills that you develop over time that make running Mythic Bastion Land so much easier, because otherwise you're improvising for 3 hours in aspects that you're unfamiliar, I guess. And I think that might be quite difficult.
The thing about whether Mythic Bastion Land is a good fit for you as a GM is basically like, when you roll up 6 myths, are you instantly inspired? You're like, oh, I have this idea, this idea, and I'll combine this and do that. Like, if that gets you excited, then I think the game has enough tools to carry you through to whatever end. It's about as complicated as most games that don't have a pre-written adventure. Yeah, that has to hook you, right? Like, you have to have those ideas.
Mm-hmm. So, like, the real test is you have to roll up 6 myths, and if you have inspiration, then it's a green light, and if you have abject fear, then it's a red light.
That's a nice way to put it, I mean.
Thomas, what's, out of the games of Mythic Bastion that you've played now, what moments is probably your favorite if I was to, like, try and sell the game on someone new?
This is a game where you can have a duel between two characters, and it will be extremely exciting. And you can die, or you could win, and either way, it will be dramatic and fun, and you don't have to do anything as the GM to make that happen. You just need to play the game. Right, you don't need to do any smoke and mirrors. You don't need to have run 1,000 games. Just play the game, and the duel will be good.
I second that. I had jousting tournaments that were amazing, and I had 2 duels with the elf and with a rival knight, and these were very memorable, very cinematic moments. Yeah. I wanted to talk about the spotlight sharing. I don't think that if you have 2 players, that it's much of a concern that one will hog the spotlight too much. Was that a conscious decision to just have 2 players, or was that more like organizational thing?
It was Judd's idea to run for 2 players. And I think that is because when Judd runs online, that's his preferred dynamic. I'm also now of that opinion that, like, when you run online, fewer players, the better. And it's not a fun thing to do sometimes, because I'll be running a game for 3 players and one of them will be like, can I invite this other person in? And I have to be like, maybe don't. Yeah, it's hard to balance spotlight. It's hard to get as much done.
Brian and William, do you have like a favorite number of players when you run?
2, hands down.
2 players, okay.
I find I get much more done. The game is much more threatening. You have this kind of like buddy cop dynamic, I guess. When there's just the 2 of you, you need to make a decision. It's like, hey, we're going there? Yeah, we're going there? Okay, we're heading out. There's just certain things like that that I find. 2 is the games that I've played, the tightest ones are with 2 players. I really enjoy 3 as well. And then 4 is the most I'll do.
My campaign is with 3 players. And there have been times when one player isn't available, so we play with 2. I feel like there have been many occasions came out because of that. They're maybe a little bit less likely to do anything too dangerous. So you get some more kind of like character-driven interactions and investigations and things like that. But now we're at the point that no one wants to miss a session. So if someone can't show up, we play something else. And it's always 3 now. So the 2-player days are behind me for the moment.
Yeah, if I was to really phrase it in the most persuasive way possible, I'd say that if you run a game with 1 GM and 2 players, the relationship between those 2 characters becomes the main character of the story in many ways.
Listeners, we ask Thomas to describe a scene that he wants us to adjudicate in a segment that we like to call You Be the Judge.
So this was a scene in the second trilogy of sessions that we played, and it's probably like the most difficult, like, again, I'm playing with people whom I really like, but this was a very difficult moment for me because I was very confused and about what was happening. And if there was a moment where I was where I had to be like, you know, was I having fun? Like, this would be the only moment I talk about. So yeah, this is a very interesting thing that happened. So my character, we were facing this myth called the wolves, and my character sort of like was the bait. And I sort of like stepped out and I was trying to draw them in. And I think Judd rolled to see, are they buying this or not, right? And he rolled, yeah, they're buying it. So their leader came alone because he's strong enough to defeat one unarmed person or whatever. And then we sprung the trap and we captured like the leader of the wolves, right? Who's this sort of like werewolfish creature. Like, just imagine, like, they're not speaking. And Judd was like, okay, you've captured them. And I, as the player, said, cool, I cut off his head. We're knights, they're the wolves, they're killing people, they're burning things. I was like, the plan has worked. I didn't want a hostage, right? Because almost of the situation that happened, it was not the plan to have a hostage. So it was just like, I'm like, here is a monster, I'm killing the monster. And then I can't remember exactly what happened. Judd narrated that, like, oh, like, because you didn't show mercy or something like that. And there was this thing, there's this weird moment where, like, I was like, wait, what's happening here, right? Like, so here's my situation. Like, yeah, like, a player has done something that they thought was perfectly, like, appropriate. Right, they were like, it's a monster, I'm killing the monsters, this is that game. And then you kind of, as the GM, this has already happened, right, in this scenario. You now suggest that was like more of a person than that player thought it was, and they have done a bad thing, right? And now the player is like, hey, wait a minute, did I do a bad, and I said this in character, like, all at a later point, like, and we had a whole conversation about this, and it's all on stream, so people can actually like go and see how it was resolved. It's handled very well. Okay. And there was even like, you know, but like, yeah, I, in character, I was like, hey, did I do something bad? So yeah, I'm interested in how you think about this, how you'd respond to this. Like, yeah.
So one thing I want to start with is, because the way the game works, it is more often than not that you will have a hostage, because it is more likely that you reduce the GD, the guard, and then you, instead of killing them, you will cause a mortal wound. And you can always say, well, I don't do anything, they will bleed out on the floor.
So this was not mechanically done, Horst. Like, this was the thing, right? The GM has just said, you sprung your trap, you've got a hostage, right?
I do understand. You just said I will chop his head off. There's no mechanical role involved. What I'm saying is that is a problem that the knights will have very often, that they have somebody at their mercy. What will they do? Will they just kill him or have them bleed out? Or will they show mercy?
Yeah.
I think for me, having knights, like even if a knight were to more outrightly break their oath, to just place that directly on the player, I don't think that's tons of fun. I think it would make sense to have the world respond to that. So in the situation of the wolf being essentially murdered in cold blood, it's like, well, who in the world would not like the fact that, you know, this bestial creature is murdered in cold blood? And it's only going to be like the most hoity-toity, you know, pious, very pure people. They'll, if they catch word, then they'll respond in a certain way.
To summon Chris McDowell into the conversation, the information choice impact doctrine, is it a doctrine? I think it might be. If we drop the idea of any kind of retconning, the information that you had is that there's a monster and it's doing harm. And you made the what seems to me the logical, reasonable choice. And then the impact, respecting what's happened so far, should be a positive impact. You've protected further harm because this monster is dead. If it seems interesting to people at the table to explore, do you feel guilty about it after the fact? I think it would be good to check in with the player and say, would you like to play a conflicted hero who questions, is violence always the right way to deal with things? And if the player says, yes, that sounds interesting, then maybe resurface this and explore it. But otherwise, I think you kill the monster and tick the box and move on.
If any of the listeners want to know how it really played out, they have to listen to your live play.
No. I just for the sake of people who don't want to spend 6 hours finding the answer to this question, I will say that my worry, again, as a player, is my GM judging me. Right now, that's my real concern, a very psychological level. It's like, are the other players at the table, do they think I did a bad thing? At the end of the session, we had a conversation about it, and it was all clear that Judd was like, no, like that's like, I'm not thinking anything and all of that stuff. I think to go even further, to convey to me that like, that wasn't, that I as a person had not done a bad thing. Judd had a scene in the next session where I think we were setting up camp at night. And then we were visited by the ghost of that wolf. One of the recurring themes of the campaign so far had been like the underworld and these beings that are some sort of like gatekeepers of the underworld or whatever. So they're like, and one of them had brought the soul of this wolf. And they were like, I can't remember exactly what they said, but it was something like, we're both warriors or whatever. But it was a kind of beautiful moment for me. Like, I was not expecting it, but I had this moment where my character was like, I can reflect that sort of like respect to you, because again, this wolf till this moment could not speak, right? Like, this was not a speaking thing, so I'm being able to speak to it for the first time. And it says, you know, we're all like, that was all fair in the world and the way we operate. And I got to say, and I will see you soon again, like in the underworld. Like, that was the kind of sentiment of like, listen, like, you know, like, I killed you and then soon I will die and I will join you and then we'll be equals. This is a very temporary, like, it's a very temporary kind of like moment in which like, I have killed you will be the truth of the world right now. It was very cool. It was very cool. Absolutely unnecessary. You know, like, I was completely at peace but we still got this like cool moment. Yeah.
Maybe years from now, when you look back on this, you may not remember anything about Mythic Bastionland, but you might remember that you killed this wolf and then his spirit came back to you.
Yeah.
It is a standout moment for me, for sure.
All right, listeners, when you will be playing Mythic Bastionland, there will be many of these standout moments. I think... Thomas for his time, and I hope to see you all next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.